So, we continue tonight in Chapter 6, Reality and the Cosmic Illusion. We were in the midst of an argument that Sri Aurobindo was making about how does duality, the double status of Brahman, arise. Either it comes about as a subjective creation of the power of Maya, but it is not based on real being. It is merely subjectivity. Or Maya is a power that imagines unrealities. Sri Aurobindo has just destroyed the second of those propositions. In the denial ensconced in the paragraph right above. And now he's going to proceed to look at this idea that Maya is Brahman's power of cosmic creation. And look at that as a possible philosophic solution. Much of this, of course, is in the context of Mayavada, the Advaita philosophy of illusionism, which asserts that real being is one and does not become diverse, does not become darkened in some process of universal becoming, never leaves its perfection. There are certain consequences that come philosophically with asserting such a rigid monism. And Sri Aurobindo is going through assiduously and looking at this argument to see if indeed this kind of monism can account for the nature of the universe that appears to us. And if it doesn't, then how is it that this universe arises and the individual within it? How is there a percipient? How is there a percept? So we begin. The other solution, the idea of a purely subjective, unreal reality, starts from the distinction made by the mind in physical nature between its subjective and objective experiences. For it is the objective alone of which it is sure as entirely and solidly real. But such a distinction could hardly exist in Brahman consciousness, since here there is either no subject and no object, or Brahman itself is the sole possible subject of its consciousness and the sole possible object. There could be nothing externally objective to Brahman, since there is nothing else than Brahman. This is indeed the position. If Brahman has the nature of non-duality, then subjectivity and objectivity cannot appear as poles apart in it. Indeed, can there in fact be a subject? Can there in fact be an object at all in what is absolutely one and undistributed? This idea, then, of a subjective action of consciousness creating a world of fictions other than or distorting the sole true object looks like an imposition on the Brahman by our mind. It imposes on the pure and perfect reality a feature of its own imperfection, not truly attributable to the perception of a supreme being. In other words, we've analogized Brahman to be as we are, based on our own faulty view of things and our own imperfection. We have foisted our imperfection on the perfect being of Brahman with that kind of an argument. On the other hand, the distinction between the consciousness and the being of Brahman could not be valid unless Brahman being and Brahman consciousness are two distinct entities, the consciousness imposing its experiences on the pure existence of the being, but unable to touch or affect or penetrate it. Well, you'll remember the context of, in which Sri Aurobindo began his arguments in the Life Divine, founding them on the reality of a conscious being whose nature is delight. But it is spoken of in three different ways: existence, sat, chit, consciousness, bliss, ananda. But they are essentially one. They are not divided. If they enter into relations within themselves, within itself, it is on the basis of a play of phenomena and not on rigid distinction. So here, this argument seems to hinge on whether we can draw a distinction between the consciousness and the being of Brahman. Are they two distinct entities? Brahman, he says, then, whether as the supreme soul self-existence or the self of the real unreal individual in Maya, would be aware by his true consciousness of the illusions imposed on him and would know them as illusions. Only some energy of Maya nature or something in it would be deluded by its own inventions, or else, not being really deluded, still persist in behaving and feeling as if it were deluded. So in other words, Brahman itself in this argument can never be lost on these impositions, on these illusions, because it would see through them. Would Maya be deluded by its own inventions? Feeling as if it's been deluded? He continues, this duality is what happens to our consciousness in the ignorance when it separates itself from the works of nature and is aware within of the self as the sole truth and the rest as not self and not real, but has on the surface to act as if the rest too were real. So here again, what he means is that the mental experience of the self here occurs like that within us, and we can, as in a sense, stand as if we are apart from that. But this solution negates the soul and indivisible pure existence and pure awareness of the Brahman. Again, existence and awareness, sat and chit. It creates a dualism within its featureless unity, which is not other in its poor part than the dualism of the double principle in the Sankhya view of things, Purusha and Prakriti, soul and nature. So if this is supposed to be monism, here we have arrived, through this logical twisting, at a dualism, which defeats the monism. So Sri Aurobindo concludes in his last sentence, these solutions, then, must be put aside as untenable unless we modify our first view of the reality and concede to it a power of manifold status of consciousness or a power of manifold status of existence. Again, chit and sat. So this argument would violate the monistic principle. A one reality cannot be two. It is actually the Mayavadin philosophy based, it is at least a school of Advaita, the not two school of Vedanta. But again, the dual consciousness, if we admit it, cannot be explained as a dual power of knowledge-ignorance, valid for the supreme existence as it is for us in the universe, for we cannot suppose that Brahman is at all subject to Maya, since that would mean a principle of ignorance clouding the eternal self-awareness. It would be to impose the limitations of our own consciousness on the eternal reality. And again, he's speaking here about a projection of our mental incapacity upon this reality as if it would suffer from the same flaws as we have. This being an absolute consciousness, an absolute being, absolutely one. An ignorance which occurs or intervenes in the course of manifestation as a result of a subordinate action of consciousness, and as part of a divine cosmic plan and its evolutionary meaning, is one thing and is logically conceivable. A meaningless ignorance or illusion eternal in the original consciousness of the reality is another thing and not easily conceivable. It appears as a violent mental construction which has no likelihood of validity in the truth of the Absolute. The dual consciousness of Brahman must be in no way an ignorance, but a self-awareness coexistent with a voluntary will to erect a universe of illusions which are held in a frontal perception, aware at once of self and the illusory world, so that there is no delusion, no feeling of its reality. So this is a position. It's not his position, which presumes a universe of illusions. The delusion takes place only in the illusory world itself, and the self or Brahman in the world either enjoys with a free participation or witnesses itself separate and intangible, the play which lays its magical spell only upon the nature mind created for her action by Maya. But this would seem to signify that the eternal, not content with its pure, absolute existence, has the need to create, to occupy itself throughout time with a drama of names and forms and happenings. It needs, being soul, to see itself as many, being peace and bliss and self-knowledge, to observe an experience or representation of mingled knowledge and ignorance, delight and suffering, unreal existence and escape from unreal existence. For the escape is for the individual being constructed by Maya. The eternal does not need to escape, and the play continues its cycle forever. So you can see the dilemma for the Mayavadin here, trying to argue that this is how the universe and the individual come into being. Does Brahman have some need? Is that why the Maya comes forth and throws out this play? Why would a perfect being, one and absolute in itself, feel a need to do that, to enter into this unending procession of universal drama? And if there's an escape, it's for the individual, right? But if, well, we'll get to that, but so let's get to it. Or, if not the need, he writes, there is the will to so create, or there is the urge or the automatic action of these contraries. But if we consider the sole eternity of pure existence attributed to the reality, all alike, need, will, urge, or automatism, are equally impossible and incomprehensible. This is an explanation of a sort, but it is an explanation which leaves the mystery still beyond logic or comprehension. For this dynamic consciousness of the eternal is a direct contradiction of its static and real nature. A will or power to create or manifest is undoubtedly there. But if it is a will or power of the Brahman, it can only be for a creation of realities of the real, or a manifestation of the timeless process of its being in time eternity. For it seems incredible that the sole power of the reality should be to manifest something contrary to itself or to create non-existent things in an illusory universe. So he's finding that this argument is insufficient. It poses a contradiction between the dynamic and the static sides of being when there should be no division at all. There should be no static or dynamic being. There should simply be being. So in this idea that we can see that if there is a creation, it must be a creation of realities within the real, because that is all that can come out of the real. The real would have no purpose in manifesting non-existent things in an illusory universe. So this is a return to his sense of things, but this is not his full argument yet. There is, so far, no satisfying answer to the riddle, but it may be that we err in attributing any kind of reality, however illusory at bottom, to Maya or her works. The true solution lies in facing courageously the mystery of its and their utter unreality. This absolute unreality seems to be envisaged by certain formulations of illusionism or by certain arguments put forward in its favor. On behalf of Advaita Vedanta, there are several schools within it, and they don't all go to the extreme in regarding the universe as an illusion. This side, then, of the problem has to pass under consideration before we can examine with confidence the solutions that rest on a relative or partial reality of the universe. So we're going to look at the extreme position first. There is indeed a line of reasoning which gets rid of the problem by excluding it. It affirms that the question how the illusion generated, how the universe manages to be there in the pure existence of Brahman, is illegitimate. The problem does not exist because the universe is non-existent. Maya is unreal. Brahman is the sole truth, alone and self-existent forever. So illusionism can outright deny the question. Brahman is not affected by any illusory consciousness. No universe has come into existence within its timeless reality. But this evasion of the difficulty is either a sophism, which means nothing, an acrobacy of verbal logic, the logical reason hiding its head in the play of words and ideas and refusing to see or to solve a real and baffling difficulty, or else it means too much, since in effect it gets rid of all relation of Maya to Brahman by affirming her as an independent, absolute non-reality, along with the universe created by her. If a real universe does not exist, a cosmic illusion exists, and we are bound to inquire how it came into being or how it manages to exist. What is its relation or non-relation to the reality? What is meant by our own existence in Maya, by our subjugation to her cycles, by our liberation from her? So our experience of something that we call the universe is here. Okay, if it is not a real universe, then it is a cosmic illusion. And we're still left with the question, how does it get here? How do we get here? Why are we able to look at it? If Maya is that which throws out this universe to experience, and our experience is involved in that, how does it come about? So it's the same question again. So the Mayavadin has avoided nothing in this logical twist. For in this view, we have to suppose that Brahman is not the percipient of Maya or her works, Maya herself is not a power of Brahman consciousness. That is to say, Brahman does not perceive Maya. Maya is not a power through which Brahman sees. And here he's talking about the idea of percipience generally. Let's see what this means to behold this appearance. Brahman is superconscient, immersed in its own pure being, or is conscious only of its own absoluteness. It has nothing to do with Maya. So this is Brahman in its absolute original concentration, before anything like a manifestation could occur. This is in its aspect of absolute pure being, lone in its existence, kevala, absolute. But in that case, either Maya cannot exist even as an illusion, or there would be a dual entity or two entities. So you see, if there's an absolute conscious or not conscious, alone in its being, above, beyond all manifestation, unapproachable, then Maya can't possibly come into existence to create anything because it is absorbed. Brahman is absorbed. How can it possibly come? Or it would be there, but that would imply that there are two entities, Brahman absorbed, and then Maya. To continue, a real eternal superconscious or conscious only of itself, that's Brahman above, absorbed, kevala, and then elusive power, Maya, that creates and is conscious of a false universe. We are back on the horns of the dilemma, because we have dualism again, and with no prospect of getting free from our impalement on it, unless we escape by concluding that since all philosophy is part of Maya, all philosophy is also an illusion, problems abound, but no conclusion is possible. For what we are confronted with is a pure, static, and immutable reality, and an illusory dynamism, the two absolutely contradictory of each other, with no greater truth beyond them in which their secret can be found and their contradictions discover a reconciling issue. So, is the question then unanswerable? This will again not be Sri Aurobindo's position. But now he continues, back to the issue. The percipience of the individual. What does the individual perceive, and is it real, is next. If Brahman is not the percipient, then the percipient must be the individual being. Remember, there's a universe that somebody is looking at. If Brahman is not looking at the universe because he's absorbed in himself above, and this universe doesn't exist, then it must be the individual who is the percipient, because somebody is looking at this universe. But this percipient, he writes, is created by the illusion, Maya, and unreal. The percept, the world, is an illusion created by an illusion and unreal. The perceiving consciousness is itself an illusion and therefore unreal. But this deprives everything of significance, our spiritual existence and our salvation from Maya, no less than our temporal existence and our immersion in Maya. All are of an equal unreality and unimportance. It is possible to take a less rigid standpoint and hold that Brahman, as Brahman, has nothing to do with Maya, is eternally free from all illusion or any commerce with illusion, but Brahman, as the individual percipient, or as the self of all being here, has entered into Maya and can, in the individual, withdraw from it. And this withdrawal is for the individual an act of supreme importance. So this is an argument that the Mayavadin might generally make for generic being, and now makes as Brahman assuming the role of the subjective individual within the self, observing the universe, ensconced in illusion, and then capable of regaining the purity of its own self, so that salvation is important and real, and being is restored at the end. Was there a beginning? Was there a continuation? Was there an end? Not really, but it seemed to it as if it was so. But here, a dual being is imposed on Brahman, a philosophic difficulty, and a reality attributed to something that belongs to the cosmic illusion. Because remember, Maya must not be real. To the individual being of Brahman in Maya, for Brahman as the self of all is not even phenomenally bound and does not need to escape from her. Moreover, salvation cannot be of importance if bondage is unreal, and bondage cannot be real unless Maya and her world are real. So even though this offers a kind of solution, and it seems to say that Brahman as self engaged in the play of Maya can always regain its freedom, it can never really be lost, right? Because of the way that we've defined it. So this practical dualism erodes at the centrality of the Mayavadin's argument in this case. The absolute unreality of Maya disappears and gives place to a very comprehensive, even if perhaps only a practical and temporal reality. To avoid this conclusion, it may be said that our individuality is unreal. It is Brahman who withdraws from a reflection of itself in the figment of individuality, and its extinction is our release, our salvation. But Brahman, always free, cannot suffer by bondage or profit by salvation, and a reflection, a figment of individuality, is not a thing that can need salvation. If Brahman is the only reality, then it is always free by definition. That's why this forceful argument keeps coming back again and again. It is irresistible. It cannot be deluded. A reflection, a figment, a mere image in the deceptive mirror of Maya cannot suffer a real bondage or profit by a real salvation. If it can, pardon me, if it be said that it is a conscious reflection or figment, and therefore can really suffer and enter into the bliss of release, the question arises, whose is the consciousness that so suffers in this fictitious existence? For there can be no real consciousness except that of the one existence. So that, once more, there is established a dual consciousness for Brahman, a consciousness or superconscience free from the illusion, and a consciousness subject to the illusion, and we have again substantiated a certain reality of our existence and experience in Maya. For if our being is that of the Brahman, our consciousness something of the consciousness of the Brahman, with whatever qualification, it is to that extent real. And if our being, why not the being of the universe? So, Sri Aurobindo is leading us ineluctably back to the conclusion that both universe and individual are real manifestations of the only being that is real. So what role does Maya play and what is Maya really? But we're not done with the arguments yet. Let us go forward with more logic. And now he'll be dealing with the perceiving self and the perceived universe. Are they unreal? It may finally be put forward as a solution that the percipient individual and the percept universe are unreal. But Maya, by imposing itself on Brahman, acquires a certain reality, and that reality lends itself to the individual and to its experience in the cosmic illusion, which endures so long as it is subject to the illusion. But again, for whom is the experience valid? The reality acquired while it endures, and for whom does it cease by liberation, extinction, or withdrawal? For an illusory, unreal being cannot put on reality and suffer from a real bondage or escape from it by a real act of evasion or self-extinction. It can only seem to some real self or being to exist. But in that case, this real self must in some way or in some degree have become subject to Maya. It must either be the consciousness of Brahman that projects itself into a world of Maya and issues from Maya, or it must be the being of Brahman that puts forth something of itself, its reality, into Maya and withdraws it again from Maya. Or what again is this Maya that imposes itself on Brahman? From where does it come if it is not already in Brahman, an action of the eternal consciousness or the eternal superconscience? It is only if a being or a consciousness of the reality undergoes the consequences of the illusion that the cycles of the illusion can put on any reality or have any importance except as a dance of phantasmagoric marionettes with which the eternal amuses himself, a puppet show in time. We are driven back to the dual being of Brahman, the dual consciousness of Brahman involved in the illusion and free from the illusion, and a certain phenomenal truth of being for Maya. There can be no solution of our existence in the universe if that existence and the universe itself have no reality, even though the reality be only partial, restricted, derivative. But what can be the reality of an original, universal, and fundamentally baseless illusion? The only possible answer is that it is a suprarational mystery, inexplicable and ineffable, anirvachaniya. In other words, the Mayavadin offers no answer, throws up his hands and walks away from the problem. Because again and again, to confront the universe is to confront the problem of manifestation. That here's a real, and here's something that seems to be derived from it, so you have two. But we have just said that the only existence is single. It is not two. So how do we overcome this philosophic problem, which is also a psychological problem, a deep spiritual problem? So we don't rest with that. There are, however, two possible replies to the difficulty if we get rid of the idea of absolute unreality and admit a qualification or compromise. Here's the first. A basis can be created for a subjective illusion consciousness, which is yet part of being, if we accept, in the sense of an illusory subjective world awareness, the account of sleep and dream creation given to us in the Upanishads. For the affirmation there is that Brahman as self is fourfold. The self is Brahman, and all that is the Brahman. But all that is the self seen by the self in four states of its being. So the four states of being are described in a number of Upanishads. Probably the most well-known are the four described in the Mandukya Upanishad, which is the basis of a lot of Vedantic argument. But it also appears, this idea of a fourfold self, in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and also in the Maitri Upanishad. In the pure self status, neither consciousness nor unconsciousness, as we conceive it, can be affirmed about Brahman. It is a state of superconscience absorbed in its self-existence, in a self-silence or a self-ecstasy, or else it is the status of a free superconscient containing or basing everything but involved in nothing. So this is that state of absolute purity. In the Mandukya Upanishad, it would be called the Chaturtha, the fourth. In the Brihadaranyaka, it is called Turiya, and that becomes the most common term used in Vedanta to describe that fourth state of absoluteness. But there is also a luminous status of sleep self, Sushupta, a massed consciousness which is the origin of cosmic existence. This state of deep sleep, in which yet there is the presence of an omnipotent intelligence, is the seed state or causal condition from which emerges the cosmos. This and the dream self, which is the continent of all subtle, subjective, or superphysical experience, and the self of waking, here he's speaking of the Swapna and Jagarita, sthanas, which is the support of all physical experience, can be taken as the whole field of Maya. As a man in deep sleep passes into dreams in which he experiences self-constructed, unstable structures of name, form, relation, happenings, and in the waking state externalizes himself in the more apparently stable but yet transient structures of the physical consciousness, so the self develops out of a state of massed consciousness its subjective and its objective cosmic experience. So again, this is an analogous argument, how this state of various standings of ourself emerge from deep sleep into dream, where we live in a very fluid world. And then we emerge from even that dream sleep and come into waking life, where forms are more stable but still perishable. This is analogized to how the universe arises from the pure self of Brahman. He continues, but the waking state is not a true waking from this original and causal sleep. It is only a full emergence into a gross external and objective sense of the positive reality of objects of consciousness, as opposed to the subtle subjective dream awareness of those objects. The true waking is a withdrawal from both objective and subjective consciousness, and from the massed causal intelligence into the superconscience superior to all consciousness. For all consciousness and all unconsciousness is Maya. So in other words, these various states of being are all predicated on that purity of self, and the real waking is not to dwell in any of those statuses, but to get back to the origination. This would be the Mayavadin part of this argument. Here, we may say, Maya is real because it is the self's experience of the self. Something of the self enters into it, is affected by its happenings because it accepts them, believes in them. They are to it real experiences, creations out of its conscious being. But it is unreal because it is a sleep state, a dream state, an eventually transient waking state, not the true status of the superconscient reality. Here, there is no actual dichotomy of being itself, but there is a multiplicity of status of the one being. There is no original dual consciousness, implying a will in the uncreated to create illusory things out of non-existence, but there is one being in states of superconscience and consciousness, each with its own nature of self-experience. But the lower states, although they have a reality, are yet qualified by a building and seeing of subjective self-constructions, which are not the real. The one self sees itself as many, but this multiple existence is subjective. It has a multiplicity of its states of consciousness, but this multiplicity also is subjective. There is a reality of subjective experience of a real being, but no objective universe. So this is a favorite position of idealism, and how there may be a reality to it, but it all is in a conceptive order, not in a real manifested this form is genuine order. Well, we won't place our feet on that unsubstantial soil. We'll go forward. I think you may have had enough philosophy and logic for one night. We won't make you a permanent captive of the illusory. Let's have some poetic delight and return to a passage we were reading last week from Book 3, the Book of the Divine Mother. We're in Canto 1, The Pursuit of the Unknowable. Across a neutral, all-supporting void, whose blankness nursed his lone immortal spirit, allured towards some recondite supreme, aided, coerced by enigmatic powers, aspiring and half-sinking and upborn, invincibly he ascended without pause. Always a signless, vague immensity brooded, without approach, beyond response, condemning finite things to nothingness, fronting him with the incommensurable. Then to the ascent there came a mighty term. A height was reached where nothing made could live, a line where every hope and search must cease, neared some intolerant bare reality, a zero formed, pregnant with boundless change. On a dizzy verge where all disguises fail, and human mind must abdicate in light, or die like a moth in the naked blaze of truth, he stood compelled to a tremendous choice. All he had been, and all towards which he grew, must now be left behind, or else transform into a self of that which has no name. Alone and fronting an intangible force which offered nothing to the grasp of thought. His spirit faced the adventure of the inane. Abandoned by the worlds of form, he strove. A fruitful worldwide ignorance foundered here. Thought's long, far-circling journey touched its close, and ineffective paused the actor will. The symbol modes of being help no more. The structure's nescience builds, collapsing failed. And even the spirit that holds the universe fainted in luminous insufficiency. In an abysmal lapse of all things built, transcending every perishable support, and joining at last its mighty origin, the separate self must melt or be reborn into a truth beyond the mind's appeal. All glory of outline, sweetness of harmony, rejected like a grace of trivial notes, expunged from being silence, nude, austere, died into a fine and blissful nothingness. Bliss be unto you. Namaste, Jai Moth.